Peace and love, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of In Defense of Liberation, the show that is working towards and educating about true people's liberation movements and revolution. I'm your host, Raven. I use she, her pronouns. And I want to thank you for checking out the program. I am happy to be able to finally feel comfortable to do this episode. I feel I've taken enough time to prepare for it, to be able to speak more clearly to some of these things rather than just generally. So today we're going to be continuing the series Colonial Connections. We're going to be talking about, well, first of all, I'll just say what we went over in part one was kind of some brief introductions to a lot of the things we're going to dive into deeper, not only just today, but in the future. So how Zionism came to be, what it is, some of the founding characters, the process of early immigration, etc. We talked about the history of Europe's interwarring and how Europe was in fact founded on thousands of years and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of corpses, which then led to the now existing nation states coming into existence. But it's still going on today. We know many different nations have continuing political and internal struggles. And we've seen this all throughout history. And so we covered some of that. We talked about the fundamental foundations and functions of colonialism, its connections to capitalism, but more importantly, the fact that colonialism and imperialism are not necessarily new phenomenons, but they are like exploitation, like class society. They are a further development, a continuation of what already exists. This shitty, torturous, awful life that thousands and millions of people have had to live through, that has forced them to endure terrible things, that has not necessarily changed so much as it has reformed itself to be able to exploit people better. We talked briefly about fascism's rise and appeasement in Europe and its connections to the other European powers and the colonial offshoots that it developed in places like the United States, Australia. And then we also talked about briefly an introduction to neocolonialism and how Zionism kind of fits within that general framework, and also its role since its foundation as a state as an international enforcer. So when we look at the history of Europe, we see that many different wars, many different so-called conflicts, many crusades, many colonial enterprises were set up in order to try to cultivate and create a larger industry, society, practice to extract and steal as much wealth, to take as much of the resources out of the ground, to force people to work in shitty ass jobs and take all of the productive labor that they have. This process, you know, it's not only European, but the character of the European projects was, by my understanding, in many ways monumentally dehumanizing For a couple reasons. First of all, because Europe, in many different periods of history, whether it's Roman history or early colonial history in the 1400s or the 1718 and 1900s or today, Europe and its bastard children have been the primary sources of enslavement and exploitation, not just simply within their own nation states, but internationally. The scale which Europe was able and is able to control is unlike ever before seen in history. And so we do have to understand that because of the fundamental existence of what we call class society, meaning that there are separate classes, society is divided, and in general, it is divided on a line between those who own, say, land, tools, who own productive forces, so resources in the ground, in the land, labor, control over labor. They own factories, maybe they own shipping lines, whatever it be. And because of that, everybody else who doesn't own any of these things is forced into either working for these people who do own these things for whatever wage that person decides to give us, in the majority of cases, if not almost all, that wage is based on a calculation that your boss, your job, your HR does to see, given where you live, the position you're in, your debt, etc., your background, what the minimum amount of money you can make in order to make it essentially to your next shift. And because of this, because, you know, of course, early class society was not as it is today, it was ownership over land, tools, the control over law, religious institutions, which allowed for the control over small to medium tracts of land, people groups, geographical locations. Whereas going into the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, you have an expansion, and up until that point as well, you have a continuing expansion of the level of control, the severity of the control, the intertwining, the interconnectedness of the control, as well as the scale of the control. And the more that it grows, the more that Britain or the United States expands its territory, grows its population, increases its production and its wealth, the more that it requires to exploit more people, the more that it requires more resources, the more that it requires more markets to sell these products to, the more it requires more land to control. So, class society, being the fundamental background of the majority of human history, at least since the very early collectivist societies and outside of indigenous societies, because of this, and even within indigenous societies, because of this around the world, exploitation, slavery, colonialism of a form, imperialism of a sort, all existed in small forms, in medium forms. But again, Europe has been, along with the United States, Australia, and New Zealand, the epicenter of extreme wealth and extreme power, not only over its quote own nation states, but over the rest of the world. So, keeping that in mind, we have to understand that Europe's and other nations search for control, search for power, also leads to resistance. And let me just say this, when a bully comes up to you or anyone on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, and they pick at you, they prod, they belittle you, they dehumanize you, they humiliate you, they spread lies about you, there will come a day in everyone's life where eventually they will no longer be able to take this kind of treatment, and they will stand up for themselves. In that moment, depending on the circumstances, depending on the situation, depending on what they are prepared to do, they will also choose the strategy and tactics that they deem necessary in order to resolve and overcome the problem that they have with this bully. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to compromise with this bully. That doesn't mean that they're going to try to make friends with this bully. That doesn't mean that they're going to focus primarily on how the bully feels or the bully's, you know, past and home life. When someone is being bullied, when someone is being brutalized, when someone is being dehumanized, they have, just like any other living organism, one thing in mind: their safety and their survival. So, two things, actually. But this must be understood, that throughout history, every single place, every single people group who has been taken advantage of, who have been enslaved, who has been tortured, they, at least a group of them, have decidedly stood up and resisted in whatever means they could, but most importantly, by whatever means were necessary. And what I am saying when I say whatever means are necessary, it goes along the lines of what Fidel Castro says in his interview, I believe, with the BBC reporter while they were still in the mountains in the Sierra Maestra. And he says, the revolutionaries did not choose the armed struggle. It was the military dictatorship. It was the capitalist ruling class. It was the police, not only just in Cuba, but around the world, who have decided that when people choose to peacefully demonstrate, when people choose to peaceably educate themselves and others, when people choose to peaceably boycott any institution or nation state they so choose, the police, the military, the political institutions, the schools, the media, everything deems them as completely inhuman, marks them as a target for death, or at the very least, ostracization and isolation. They pay people on TikTok, they pay people on Twitter to spend a majority of their time not only just spreading misinformation, but bombarding the comments and other page categories on these social media sites in order to overwhelm and intimidate pro-Palestinian people, even children. So when we say that those who resist will resist by any means necessary, what we mean is that if someone is facing a certain level of persecution, harassment, or threats and actual acts against themselves, their minds, their people groups, their society, they have every right, not only in international law, which nobody gives a shit about anyways, but in human and living nature, to resist however it is needed to in order to survive. If they have bombs dropped on them, at the very least, they should be able to take guns and do something about that. If they are being arrested, then at the very least, they should be able to try to find ways to escape those prisons, to take out those who are arresting them and make sure that they can't arrest other people, to make sure that those who are being sought after by the police forces are not found. This is the right of any people, irregardless of who they may be. But it is especially true in the case of the Palestinian people, because they have been under occupation for over 75 years. But more importantly than the outright occupation of the State of Israel starting in 1948, Palestine has been under colonial or other forms of control for hundreds of years. If we're just talking about the mistreatment and the land theft and the death caused by Zionism and Jewish immigration, then we can count 110 to 140 years or so. But if we're talking the inability to develop a national consciousness, the inability to develop and control its own institutions, its own economy, this is hundreds of years in the making. So if at this point, those who are still alive, who over 45% of whom are children, if they choose in this moment to pick up arms, to struggle, to form guerrilla movements, to fight outright against their occupier, there is not a single human soul, not a single media corporation, not a single political party who can convince me or others, millions of whom, billions of whom around the world agree that the Palestinians are doing anything that we and you wouldn't do if we were in the exact same position. So continuing on this point, when we look at the early formations of the actual systematization, so not just like, okay, one person in this random corner of the globe decided, I'm going to enslave people and force them to work, but the actual development of a social and political entity, so a group of people who have come together and decided to live amongst one another with similar laws, similar traditions, similar ways of life, is founded on and exists through the process of stealing land, through massacring civilians on that land through enslaving all groups within the population, not limited to, say, men, and then forcing them to labor intensely, awfully, inhumanely on the land that you stole from them in extremely dangerous conditions, with no water, with no food, with no rights, with no ability to leave, no ability to choose, no ability to say anything, no ability, in some cases, to even speak to the people next to you without getting killed or whipped or worse. Once societies began to be based on this type of practice, you had some of the earliest forms of colonialism. Now, colonialism comes in many different forms. I think it's, you know, not necessarily important to list through the different forms, because honestly, it's just kind of semantics. But essentially, colonialism is primarily a practice where one group of people controls directly or imposes, you know, some kind of form of control on top of people through often colonies for economic advancement and for other political and social reasons, and is able to and needs to develop its own kind of conditions dependent on wherever it may be, dependent on the attempt by the mother country, the colonizing group, to try to mystify what is really happening, to kind of protect itself from what it knows will happen, what happens every time, which is resistance. And by this kind of logic, colonialism doesn't look the same in every time, every place throughout history. Colonialism is, in many ways, extermination, slavery, religious indoctrination, kidnapping, the spread of diseases and viruses, a strategy to divide and conquer the populations based on things like race, gender, sexual orientation, religious beliefs, or national and ethnic, or what are commonly called, quote, tribal lines. The setup of settlerism, settler colonialism, the insertion, the immigration, quote-unquote immigration, of the colonizing powers' population, oftentimes members of the population who are deemed unwanted for whatever reason, who then are shipped in to the colony in order to settle on and create a colonial society for themselves above and beyond the people who were already living there, the indigenous inhabitants, for the purpose of, in many ways, kind of having a sacrificial lamb. I mean, I don't know if that's really the most fundamental purpose, but it certainly is a good one. We also have to understand that this suits the economic interests of the type of society that we have. So when we talked about class society before, we talked about the fact that there are those who own and control things, and there are those who are forced to work. Of course, those who are forced to work, forced to labor, whether they're paid or unpaid, they are not given a significant amount of, or even a majority of, their profits from the sale of the products they created, or ownership over the products they helped create through their labor itself. when we look at the poor indigenous workers who have to live on agricultural serfdoms, essentially, when we look at the African populations who have to, like in the Congo, have children as young as 2 or 3 years old digging with their hands in the dirt to mine cobalt. When this is happening, those people don't get to turn around and say, this cobalt is mine. They don't get to say, these tomatoes or this banana or this t-shirt, if they're working in a factory, is mine and mine to sell. But they have to take that product they've created with their own two bare hands through the interaction between human beings and nature. And they have to give that product up to another person to be able to profit from it. Because that is the general way that our world works, it goes without saying that it suits the interests of those who control that, who are in charge of that, who are making the money off of that, to push that shit forward as much as they can so that they can make as much money as their hearts desire. Literally making as much money as is physically possible. They are actively destroying the very planet we live on to make more trillions of dollars when they already got some trillions. I don't know about you. I don't even have a million to rub together over here. So, you know, the fact of the matter is that the goal of this is not just hatred, right? It's not like one day white Europeans in what we now call Britain woke up and said, I'm tired of killing and colonizing other white Europeans. I want to go ahead and kill a bunch of African folks or a bunch of Indians over in the East, or I want to go kill a bunch of Sioux or a bunch of Lakota, or I'm going to go kill those in Chiapas. I'm going to go into, you know, this area and I'm going to kill these brown folks. Like, that kind of consciousness took a time to develop. And in fact, racism was not the function or the goal or the reason why, say, colonialism or slavery or anything happened. Because ideas do not come before reality. The example I'll give is the example that Kwame Ture gives about Karl Marx discovering, quote-unquote, Marxism. But I'm going to twist it a little bit and say, gravity existed, like the force of gravity, before anybody discovered it, let alone tried to come up with a justification for it. Slavery has existed for almost all of time, almost, in different severities, in different levels, for different reasons, other than the one primary and fundamentally shared reason between them all, and that is wealth and power. Wealth and power. What racism is a backdoor justification just in case anybody turns around and says, hey, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Then they get to say XYZ racist thing. And then that person turns around and says, oh, right, I'm white, I should be able to do this because they're not. Insert all way worse racist ideas, right? So, I say this because colonialism and the process, the practice, the dehumanization existed before there was like a global or even in many cases a really strong national sense of, well, national sense in the first case. You know, it took a long time for people to call themselves British or American or what have you, right? But more importantly than that, it took them a long time to hate someone else, to be willing to do, say, and act towards someone else a certain way that dehumanized them, that harmed them, without questioning it. That took a period of time. And what was happening during that whole period of time? People were being enslaved. So, again, the purpose of explaining this is just to say that colonialism, at the end of it all, is for economic reasons, which lead into political and social reasons, which require some kind of justification, which is oftentimes made up on the spot and developed over time. But the slaves are already in the shackles before anybody says, this is the reason why. Do you get my point? And it is not only through enslavement. The reason why we have to understand how colonialism and imperialism and neocolonialism and Zionism and fascism are how they are today is because they're not exactly the same to how they were yesterday. And if we pretend that a general understanding is going to help us to protect ourselves, is going to help the Palestinian people or the Congolese people to defend themselves, then we are fooling ourselves, all of us. So let's take a step back and just focus on the point that Europe, right, was and is a history of wars, like outright. If you look at the list of conflicts in Europe, if you just go on Wikipedia and search list of conflicts in Europe, if you start on the section 1st through 10th century CE, there is approximately 300 wars just in that period that claimed millions of lives. You go into the 11th century, the same is true. About 150 wars claimed millions of lives. You go into the 12th century, the 13th century, the 14th century. You go back into the 200 BCE. You go back to pre-BCE. You go all the way back to some of the earliest forms of written history or the earliest found artifacts to show us a history. Going all the way back to something like 5000 BCE. And you got wars of colonization happening in Europe. Now, this is not to say that European people outright are just bad. Because, shoot, then I'd have to just say that about myself. And I'll put it out there that there's some truth to it. I mean, when you're born white, even if you're not European, if you have white-like skin, there are things about your day-to-day life which are not dangerous that if you were to have even a tan or an olive-colored skin, you would face some difficulties. Like going into the grocery store or having an interaction with a police officer. These are things that are a danger to non-white people that are not a danger to white people. And that creates a certain kind of comfortability subconsciously and encourages racism in a way that forces us to have to really reckon with the fact that we, as white people, really tend to put our own self-interest above and beyond anybody else. And I'm not saying that as a blanketed statement. We can look at history. We can look at the way that European settlers throughout American history, quote-unquote American history, were primed for the perfect role of crushing alongside with the other oppressed masses, the more oppressed masses, speaking of the indigenous, the Africans, the Asians, the Latinos, the Chicanos, etc., to crush colonialism, to crush capitalism. And 9 times out of 10, a majority of them have chosen to side with the ruling class, at least for some brief period of time, at least subconsciously, in order to not fully commit to a real revolutionary cause that would free them too. Simply because, in my understanding, it doesn't focus primarily on white people. In fact, if we were to have a revolution, especially in the United States, white people would have to reckon seriously with the history of our ancestors, as well as the current trajectory of our community at this moment, becoming increasingly more fascist, increasingly more far right wing. So anyways, when you look at Europe's history of interwarring, right, what you have to also see is that many of those wars were not just outright land thefts, right? But many of these so-called wars were in fact wars of colonial domination. They were firing against revolting citizens, against so-called runaway slaves, against indebted servants, against workers, against the unemployed. These were not all and cannot all be considered war. In the same way that what is happening in Palestine right now cannot primarily be classified as a classic war. Because a war, in many cases, an outright, you know, declaration of war, often requires two states, two nations, two governments, or more, to declare war and act through their national armed groups, national armed bodies, in order to defeat the other. The Palestinian people have no national formation. They have no state of any validity or worth. They have no national army. They don't have a national guard. They don't have police forces. What they have is resistance groups. They have people like you and me, but more importantly, people who have gone through absolute living hell, who have decided after their mother or their child or their entire family was murdered, that they were going to fight using the same methods that were being used against them. The issue, however, is the state of Israel is a nuclear-armed nation. They have more weapons funding than basically anybody else in the area, primarily coming from the United States, which is the largest imperialist country in the world. We're going to keep a pin in that. But for the moment, I'll just say, remember that down to it, colonialism is an economic system. You have the largest military, the highest funded military in the region, fighting against a group of people who not only do not have a national army, a national guard, or a police force, do not have a government or a nation state of their own, but also with people who have been forced out of their homes, who are living in refugee camps, who are living on the side of the street in tents, who are not able to feed themselves properly, who do not have, in many cases, running water, who do not have bathroom facilities, who cannot wash themselves, who cannot get on the internet in many places, who do not have electricity in many places. This is what the largest military entity in all of West Asia, the so-called Middle East, is fighting against. People. And when you think in the context of war, you are placing the Palestinian people on an equal footing to the state of Israel. And this is just plainly not the case. This is not to disregard what the Palestinian people are doing, because in fact I think this is more than anything a testament to how strong the Palestinian people are, that they are doing this, that they are taking this on, and that they are struggling to really end occupation, that this is the moment to end it all for many, that this is the time to end occupation. After 100+ years of this shit, that's incredible. But my point is just that when we see international bodies or political parties or organizations framing this genocide as a war, what it does is it normalizes genocide. Because that's like the United States calling its genocide of over 95% of the indigenous population of North America the, quote, Indian Wars, unquote. The largest and longest ongoing military excursion that the U.S. government has ever gone on is a genocidal campaign of land theft, mass murder, rape, the burning of villages, attempted enslavement, etc., which is exactly what they have taught and shown the so-called Israelis that are doing it to the Palestinians today. This is what they have taught many others to do to their people or to the people in surrounding nations to them. But this was not the United States that learned this first. We must remember Europe created what we now call the United States. Europe created the boundaries and dividing lines in what we now call Africa's nation states. And the same goes for Asia. Europe has done more damage to the world than can be calculated and understood without having to go on months-long tangents about specific periods of history. Like, the depths of extermination campaigns, I don't even have the words for it, you know what I mean? But this is why it has to be understood that, again, there is a reason for this that is not just hatred, but it's an economic system. So let's talk about that more deeply. During the foundation of what became known as the World Zionist Congress, from an outsider's perspective, it was clear that only certain types of people were able to participate not only in this event, but in the actual development of Zionist ideology. And I say this because when you look at the funders who gave money to the earliest immigrations, the earliest land thefts, the earliest paramilitary groups, it was not poor trade unionist factory worker who happened to be Jewish. But in many cases, it was people who weren't even Jewish, but happened to have a lot of money. Happen to have a lot of power. Someone like Lord Balfour. Someone like the Rothschilds. These characters, like Wiseman and Theodore Herzl and others, were not oppressed, poor, working class, Jewish people fighting for a liberation struggle against their oppressors. This was, in its earliest iterations in 1897, a colonial enterprise set up and founded by European powers like Switzerland, Britain, France, Germany, and others. Belgium, Russia, all of whom contributed not only funds, but also populations of Jewish people that they themselves did not want within their own countries. And this is a second point that I want to make about the Zionist project being colonial in character. Rather than seeking out territory or control politically within Europe or within Russia or within Africa, where Jewish people had been oppressed and exploited systematically, they instead sought out land in Argentina, in Nigeria, and in Palestine, ultimately landing on Palestine mainly for its biblical mythology, in order to exploit and oppress people in the same exact way that Jewish people had been exploited and oppressed in Spain, that they had been exploited and oppressed in Egypt, that they had been exploited and oppressed in Britain, that they had been exploited and oppressed throughout Asia, throughout the world. And yet, what did the Zionists, again, many of whom were not Jewish, Theodore Herzl, he was an atheist. What did Theodore Herzl say on his very one and only visit to historic Palestine? Let me read it for you. This is coming from the Hundred Years' War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi. Shout out, I can't think of who did the interview, but there was an interview that just came out from him. It was very well done. I can't think of the name of the host, so my deepest apologies to them. So, again, this was the very one and only time that Herzl had visited. And because of that, I am currently looking at the wrong quote. My apologies. Let me Google it on the laptop here. So, he says, we must expropriate gently the private property on the state assigned to us. We shall try to spirit the penniless population across the border by procuring employment for it in the transit countries while denying it employment within our own. The property owners will come over to our side. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly. Let the owners of the immovable property believe that they are cheating us, selling us things for more than they are worth. But we are not going to sell them anything back. In 1897, he outlined one of the most important goals for Zionism at the first Zionist Congress as well. He said, we have an important task before us. We have met here to lay the foundation stone of the house that will someday shelter the Jewish people. We have set to aim at securing legal, international, and other guarantees for our work. He talked a lot about also in his interactions with different Palestinian leadership, Herzl and other World Zionist Congress leadership, gave a very patronizing and condescending view towards the Palestinian struggle. Because, again, they were not in any way interested in the needs of the Palestinian people. This was a colonial enterprise. The goal is to enslave or to exterminate or to expel the indigenous population from the land. In doing so, many of the Palestinian leaders who had developed negotiated stances, compromises, strategic retreats, if you might call them that, who tried to meet with the leadership of the Zionists in order to develop some kind of system, some kind of compromise, they were condescendingly told, as Palestinian people were being brutalized and watching their land being taken, that nothing was to happen to the Palestinian people. In 1917, when the Balfour Declaration came out, it finishes one of its paragraphs by saying that no harm should come to the indigenous inhabitants of the Palestinian territory. But what's crazy about that is they, in their own devilish, you know, surgical maneuvering, were laying the foundation of the argument which we're seeing today, which is that, in fact, they believe that the Israelis, the Jewish people specifically, were the indigenous inhabitants, and that the current inhabitants were not, in fact, to be considered. They were called the non-Jewish population. In 1917, already setting the standard that that land was to be Jewish land, and everyone else, even the Muslim majority, was to be declared, in fact, simply non-Jewish. So, this is all to bolster the point that whether it's the 1922 mandate over Palestine by Britain, whether it's the 1917 invasion by Britain, throwing out the Ottoman Turks, and releasing the Balfour Declaration, whether it is in 1897 at the World Zionist Congress, or in the 1860s when some of the first waves of European and Russian Jews began coming into Palestine, the overall goal was to create a state for the Zionists, not Jewish people, because the Arab Jewish population, which came to live under occupation, was in fact expelled. If they weren't outright expelled, they were made second-class citizens, Christians, and Jewish people. Within Palestinian society, pre-occupation, were not exploited and oppressed to the level that even Jewish people who do not happen to be European, who do not happen to be settlers, are brutalized, made second-class citizens, even within a so-called Jewish state. And the Jewish people must continue to stand up against this. They must continue to struggle against Zionism's attempt to act in their name. They must continue to fight against Zionism's attempt to develop a state in the name of Jews, in the name of Judaism, that is based on the very same systematic oppression and genocidal campaigns which the Nazis, but also the Europeans of other fascist trends before them, sought out against the Jewish population. How can any Jewish person stand to support watching a worse and a more developed, a more technologically advanced, a more systematized, a more controlled, a more manipulatable, a more easier to hide Holocaust is happening in their name against people who have not done anything as a people against the Jewish population to match anything at all that Europe continues to do to the Jewish population? So turning now to kind of looking at the consequences, the results, the reactions, both positive and negative, to the development of colonialism. We have to talk about not only the period of history whereby Britain, France, Italy, Spain, etc., went out and tried to colonize people across the ocean, but we also have to talk about the consequences of the colonialism which happened within Europe. So jumping back a little bit here, as we said earlier, colonialism and war is not new, right? Christopher Columbus, Pizarro, Cortez, and others who sailed across the Atlantic into the Caribbean, into Mexico, into southeastern North America, and into South America, did not, in fact, create a new phenomenon. What they were doing was actually traveling farther to do exactly what their ancestors had done for thousands of years. When we talk about Europe's colonial prowess, we tend to look at the case of the Irish as one of the first instances. But again, let me remind us that Europe, as the homie over at East Is a Podcast said, Europe doesn't exist. Europe is a made-up name for a made-up entity. Because that used to be Rome, or the Roman Empire. Many of those territories then became known as the Greek Empire, and many other such empires before and after them. During those times, back in the BCE era, turn of AD, the practice of enslaving another population, stealing their land, and forcing them to either leave to labor on that land or outright killing them was in fact a practice for almost every class that dominated throughout this period of time. The levels of violence, of course, were varying, and the contradictions within, say, slavery were not always so heightened as to say the character of slavery that happened in the East against Europeans, albeit not a good thing, right? We can all agree slavery is bad. But when you compare that to chattel slavery, which happened throughout Europe, and especially in Europe's colonies in the Americas, you see a type of slavery that in fact removes the human being which is being enslaved and replaces it with a human being looking piece of equipment. An African person in this type of slavery was considered, in many cases, even less than an ox, than a goat, than a horse, or a saw. They were seen to be just as expendable as a piece of wood. Maybe not as expendable, as slaves did tend to be expensive. But it's not as if those who were owning slaves didn't have the money. So I think the comparison still holds up. The reason why I mention this is because we tend to look at the history of the last 500 years as somehow fundamentally different in its base to other periods in history. And I don't know that we all think that. I don't know that we all believe that, but we tend to focus, you know, our critiques, our statements within the last 500 years. You know, we tend to say, like, colonialism and imperialism have dominated over Africa, Asia, and Latin America for 500 plus years. And that is true. But colonialism and imperialism has also dominated over the territories which it inhabited for far longer and had sought out territory elsewhere prior to just simply 500 years ago. The difference is they couldn't maybe get there so easily or so quick. They couldn't keep control as well. They didn't have the technology to control all the different regions which they were controlling. But still, the Romans conquered, colonized, and controlled through an imperialist system the so-called Roman territories. But again, once that became so much more normal, and not only just normal, but necessary for survival of these systems, you had ruling leaders trying to find new ways to control these groups of people, these territories, these lands, without having to face resistance, oftentimes responding to the different forms of resistance by developing new forms of repression. Some that might be more brutal, others that might be more psychological, more focused on the mind, more manipulative. And as we look back into so-called European history, we can tie dots to Rome's many different conquests, directly to the Crusades, directly to the wars led by the Habsburgs, directly to wars between nations like Hungaria, Bulgaria, or Jesus, Hungary. The region that we know as the Balkans has been a hotbed of war for centuries, centuries longer than what we now call European colonialism. And yet, many of those campaigns were cultivated, led by, or benefited from by Europe thousands, hundreds of years ago. These very same ruling class interests that at one time controlled, say, the clergy or owned land that was farmed by serfs and slaves, who were kings and queens or married them, they went on to have children with others who would then be granted, these children, control over legal systems, over developing media forms, over education. They'd control healthcare or production, certain forms and sectors of the economy. This would be granted outright to these individuals, not because necessarily of any technical qualities or capabilities that they may have, but most importantly because whoever they are or whoever they are connected to controls land, property, political power, what have you. And so they are nepotistically put in these positions where they get to make millions deciding the fate of millions of people, not millions of dollars, millions of people, billions of dollars. And all the while, they are thinking not simply what is necessary for human survival, but they are thinking more concretely what is necessary for my human survival, what is necessary for my continued control, what is necessary for my continued wealth accumulation. The same was true in Palestine. Palestine, like almost every other nation in the world, every other people group in the world, had a class society. In Palestine, there were wealthy Palestinians and there were poor Palestinians. In Palestine, there were those who had political powers and privileges and those who didn't. In Palestine, there was religious leadership that did have a level of control over society that their religious practitioners within those religions did not have outright. Now, I bring this up because it is important to understand that as things are today, the Palestinian people have never been more united than they are right now. And that has happened through a process of colonialism, through a process of resistance, not through a process of compromise, not through a process of laying down and accepting occupation. Unity has been built through struggle. The Palestinian people have also been attempted to be taken advantage of by other Palestinian people. You have many leadership throughout the years, as I mentioned, especially during the early days of the beginning of British and Zionist occupation, who tried to develop some form of compromise in order to, as they said, grant the Palestinians as much land and power as they could, but more importantly, to avoid having to sacrifice the positions in which they lived in for the risk of actually having to fight against colonialism. Because the Palestinian population, who throughout the process of colonialism, throughout the process of Zionist settler colonialism, did not have control over the media sources, did not have workers' rights, did not have political power, many of them were forced to listen to, believe, or at the very least kind of live within the reality that was being told to them by their occupiers. But yet, the majority of the Palestinian people, if and when given an opportunity, such as during the 20s, such as from 1936 to 1939, such as throughout the early days of occupation, throughout the Nakba and the Intifadas, have resisted against occupation, now are resisting on such a more unified level, albeit still with contradictions, but that has only been reached through the process of resistance. And that process of resistance is not something that I think any of the Palestinian people would have chosen. None of them outright said, I want to live in an occupied territory and struggle with arms against my occupiers. The Palestinian people were born into a society where they had two choices, to live or to die, to struggle or to lay down and suffer and cease to exist. These are the fundamental decisions which are available for every Palestinian person. And in these moments throughout history, the Palestinian people have chosen to rise up. However, the quality and the character of that struggle continues to develop with each time they resist, with each time they revolt, with each time they are repressed. And so now what we are seeing in Palestine is not a bunch of people who just decided one day they're going to pick up guns and they're going to shoot people. No. The majority of the people in Palestine right now, the majority of the people throughout the so-called axis of resistance in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Kuwait, all these different areas, have watched as their parents, as their children, as their cousins, as their brothers have been made into martyrs. And they have dedicated their lives not only to military training, but to the development of principles, whether they be religious, political, or what have you. They have developed organizations. They have trained. They have educated themselves. They have built relationships with the community. They have developed institutions for healthcare, for food, for education, for transportation, for legal things, for all kinds of stuff. And at the same time, have prepared themselves for what they have faced every single day, which is armed interactions and conflict with their occupiers. And if and when at this point, or at any point during the occupation of Palestine, someone or someone's multiple people have decided that it is arms and armed struggle that is going to free them, that I believe cannot be judged, disagreed with, condemned, or even questioned by anyone who is not within the Palestinian people's living situation, material conditions, and existing context. Because right now, if you have a house, you don't know what you're talking about. Right now, if you have a job, you don't know what you're talking about. Right now, if you can go to the doctors, you don't know what you're talking about. Right now, if you have food in your house, you don't know what you're talking about. So, for the Piers Morgans and the CNNs and the different media stations that bring on Palestinians themselves and demand of them some kind of character judgment of one of the very few groups that is still around, that hasn't been killed, that is willing to stand up and fight against someone who is willing to exterminate them. This is an absolute disrespectful slap in the face of every human being around the world, because there has been a time for many, And there will come a time for all of us where we will be put in a similar situation to what the Palestinian people are living through today, where we will no longer be able to take the forms of exploitation and oppression which we are facing, where the African masses, where the Asian people, where indigenous nations, where folks who have been taken advantage of, who have been tortured, who have seen war, who have had their homes burned down, who have lost all control over their entire society, who can't even speak their own language anymore because it's been taken from them, will decide. They will decide what it is they are willing to do, what it is they are willing to sacrifice in order to live freely. And that decision cannot be held against anybody except for those who push them towards the position to have to make it. If the Palestinian people were occupied or were not occupied right now, they wouldn't have to take up guns. They wouldn't have to struggle. If the Palestinian people were in control of their own territories, their own economics, their own employment, their own political system, they would not have to fight against anyone other than those who are trying to take that away from them. And so, when we look at who it is that is preventing them from even having these levels of control, the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and especially, of course, Israel, along with nations like Saudi Arabia and the Arab regimes who have refused, even as they talk about the Palestinians, to do anything meaningful for the Palestinians, each and every one of them is the reason why Palestinian peoples right now have to do anything other than just live their life peaceably, live their life in existence and tolerance and cohesion and cooperation with anybody else, just like everybody else is supposed to. But we know not only do the Palestinians not have this, but also the indigenous peoples of the Americas do not have this. And so if the Zapatistas decide to take up arms in 1994 and struggle to control Chiapas, no one can blame anyone except for the U.S. and Mexican states, except for the Spanish Empire who colonized Mexico. Nobody can blame the indigenous people of Bolivia for doing what they've done with their economy, doing what they've done with their nation state, especially without arms, in many cases without arms, and condemn them before condemning anyone who took part in creating the levels of misery, poverty, and suffering that exist not only in Bolivia, but throughout the Americas. Nobody can blame a Vietnam or a China or a North Korea or whomever from having nuclear weapons when the largest nuclear power in the world has bombed each and every one of them continuously for years, in and out of periods of so-called war, and not only with quote-unquote conventional bombs, but also nuclear bombs, napalm, white phosphorus, and other chemicals that cause insane amounts of damage to the soil, to the environment, and to the children and people living in the area. But from 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel, Ben Gurion announcing it and assuming the role of Prime Minister, through to today, is all justification for October 7th, is all justification for the Palestinian people to do whatever is necessary. And so I don't have to condemn it, I don't have to approve it, I don't have to have an opinion on anything. What I have to do is recognize here in my situation how to understand their situation and also how to understand mine. Because if the Palestinian people know something, it's that we can't sit around and keep letting this shit happening to us. If the Palestinian people are correct in anything, it is that we will meet our occupiers and our oppressors with the means by which we have to free ourselves without any hesitation. That is a cry for humanity. That is a spiritual event in a way that cannot be brought into spoken language. It moves us to tears. Seeing what is happening to these children. Seeing what is happening to these people. And yet, many of us do not do anything meaningful to put a stop to this, and also to put a stop to what is happening around us. All of this needs to be understood as part and parcel of the same system, part and parcel of the same ruling class. Israel is not separate from the United States, other than geographically. The United States is not separate from Europe, other than geographically. Albeit, these nations, these groups, these ruling classes do have their contradictions, do have their differences, do have different political systems, do have different social norms. They all have, at the end of the day, the same interest. And that is to exploit the masses of people wherever they are. To take resources out of the land and to make as much money from those resources. To use those profits to create massive militaries in order to continue to be able to exploit and steal resources and steal land. So, albeit not the most detailed description and historical understanding, I hope that what we talked about here today is useful in order to get a context for what really has happened in Palestine and what really has happened throughout history. And that is that people have been oppressed, people have been taken advantage of, people have been brutalized. And then, after a period of time of watching that, of taking that, of dealing with that, they have decided at the final moment to not take it anymore. And then they are punished for that. Do not forget that there is a history to these struggles. That what the Palestinian people are doing today is not new. What the indigenous people have done throughout the world is a history we must understand deeper and more in depth than I really feel I can provide. So please do your research. Read. Watch YouTube videos. Look up documentaries. Talk to people. The internet, albeit one of the worst places in the world, is also one of the most useful places in the world. Because if you know how to, you can find information about just about anything. That doesn't mean it's all factual. That doesn't mean it's all useful. But it does mean that you can read that, you can measure it up against reality, and you can make a conscious and informed decision by doing that type of self-education. The last thing I want to say is that as we are witnessing the rise in far-right politics, in fascism, in extermination campaigns, as we are watching all kinds of so-called rights, whether they be working rights, whether they be healthcare rights, whether they be political rights, being taken away every single day, we have to understand that the period of time we are in is not a period of time to sit around and ask ourselves, is this fascism? Because, first of all, yes, we can disagree on that, but I don't care. Second of all, does it matter if it fits within the definition of what we think is fascism, or does it matter that it's really fucked up and looks like something that has happened in the past, and so we need to look at what others have done in the past to fight these levels of extreme repression? And third is to understand that, in fact, fascism was, in many ways, stopped from being able to continue to grow past the point which it did, but it was never fully extinguished. Fascism was allowed to breed, was allowed to grow, was allowed to develop in the minds of millions through the compromises, the retreats, and the hiding with and of fascist collaborators, fascist leaders throughout Nazi Germany, throughout Italy, throughout Spain, throughout Portugal, throughout Chile, all of these different nations, like Brazil that has had a military dictatorship, the Philippines, which has had ongoing forms of fascism throughout history, like all of these nations have been protected by the United States. And Zionist leaderships are no different. Fascism in the 30s and 40s, right, looked very different to what it is today. In the same way that colonialism looked very different back in Roman times to what it looked like during the Spanish Inquisition versus what it looks like today. The same has to be said for war, for class struggle, and for neocolonialism. Each of these has to be reimagined, re-understood, redeveloped, re-studied. Not just based off of what Nkrumah said in the 60s, or what Castro said in the 70s, or what Ortega said in the 80s, or now, but actually understanding not only the conditions of the nations and places where revolutions have happened, but looking also at the places that we live today, so that we can really inform people, so that we can really talk to them in a way that does not come off as ignorant, but does also not come off as condescending, so that people can be encouraged to become a part of whatever they and we want to build together, because they know they're working with someone who's serious. And most importantly, because if and when the moment comes to make any kind of changes, we can't just base it off of the general idea of change that we might have in our heart. But we actually have to understand, okay, what material systems, structures, ideas, norms, whatever, are in place to create what we have today, and which of them can and should be removed, and how, in order to get us to a better place. Not just, we need to pass another bill, or we need to get this person elected, but how about we get rid of the system that has had so many bills, so many elected officials come in and out of these spaces, while colonialism, imperialism, racism, transphobia, exploitation, abuse, all of these different things have been allowed to blossom, to grow, right alongside with fascism. If this is the case, then we have to abandon those things which have not turned out successes, which have not turned out in the way that we have needed, and turn towards strategies and tactics which lead towards a conclusion, not a pause, not a adjustment, not a compromise with oppression, but an end to oppression everywhere. That is the necessity. So we must understand that neocolonialism as it exists today, neoliberalism as it exists today, are yet again new iterations to control and to divide and to exploit the people. And we have to understand them, we have to look at them, we have to study them, and we have to know what they are today, what they are right now. With that, my friends, I'll just say I hope that listening back through this, I feel comfortable enough posting this, because this is now the sixth time I have recorded this episode, and I still feel like I didn't get as much real concrete data, real dates, real names out on the table. So if that is really something you're looking for, please let me know and I can put my fucking ass into it. But emotionally speaking, this episode is, you know, this whole time is awful for everyone, and I'm just happy that there are those who are still alive who are resisting, and I'm happy more than ever and grateful for the life that I have, and I am, you know, completely and utterly ashamed and saddened and disappointed by the loss of innocent life in Palestine, of those who have done nothing to deserve even a hand being raised against them. This is a people who have been occupied and oppressed for over 100 years. My heart breaks, but I continue to struggle, as we all must, because we do not have the time, we do not have the ability and we are not afforded the privilege to fail, just as the Palestinian youth movement said. All power to the people.